Welcome to Managing Tech Millions, the podcast for tech professionals navigating the journey from high earners to confident wealth managers. Struggling with equity compensation decisions? Are you curious about turning your portfolio into a thriving, scalable business? You're in the right place. Master your millions, own your legacy. Join us each week as we uncover strategies, share actionable insights, and help you take charge as CEO of your financial future. Excited today to have everybody get a chance to meet again, Marco Quevedo. Marco Quevedo is a good personal friend of mine, and he is also the chief investment officer of a nine-figure family office. Today, we really want to walk through in detail how the architect phase of wealth ops really maps directly to how billion-dollar family offices are operating. Who's better to do that than somebody who's actually sitting in that seat? Marco, good to see you.
I appreciate it. Ready to roll.
Yeah. So for those of you who don't know, Marco and I did do undergrad together at UC San Diego. Let's go Tritons. And then went to go conquer the Silicon Valley. A few years into our journey, Marco decided that he needed to get some more education, went to Wharton, MBA, investment banking, and then started working in family offices. So he has been somebody who's been a mentor of mine as I've started trying to understand how to build my own micro family office. So I always get excited when we have these conversations because we have the ability to go broad on some things, but also to go incredibly deep. When you go in, and I know you've been a part of actually starting a couple of family offices, how do they start defining goals for their wealth? What does that process look like?
So I think I'll start with, you know, there's a saying in the family office world, and I think it's true actually, is that if you've met one family office, you've met one family office. They all do tend to operate a little bit differently depending on the individuals and their goals and whatnot. But from a high level, they generally all start from a similar place, which is that family offices, they don't start with investments. They start with purpose. What is this wealth for? And so I think from that lens, there's a few layers that are worth naming. There's lifestyle considerations. You know, what do you need this money to do for you right now? There's legacy considerations. What do you want to leave and to whom? And then there's protection considerations. There's, you know, what are you protecting against? Is it creditors or taxes or dilution or whatever it happens to be? And an important part of goal setting is time horizon as well. Am I looking for something to be more short-term in nature or more long-term in nature? Am I in the later stages of my life or am I in the earlier stages of my life? So thinking through what your goals are is kind of the starting point where most family offices start defining what a family office looks like.
And having been a part of that process, I mean, is it really posing those questions and then, you know, the founders of the family office really sort of sit through and think through those and then you have meetings to discuss those? Bring this to life a little bit more for the people who are doing it on a smaller scale.
Certainly, family offices can decide to operate in a couple different ways. They can keep a lot of it in-house, and by in-house, I mean like within the family. There's others that decide to bring in partners and people and kind of let them run with investment making decisions, estate planning, taxes, that sort of thing. But in my opinion, most family offices, it's important that they start from the beginning, from a goal setting standpoint, that includes the family. Because ultimately, the family is the one who's going to define what the goals are for our wealth. You know, we've worked hard to build this wealth. What do we want to do with it? That's a question that really the family needs to answer. Whether they do that amongst themselves or with advisors, I think different families make different decisions in that way. But a lot of people make the mistake of like trying to skip the step of defining goals and go straight to, where should I be investing? Well, the answer to that question of where should I be investing is driven or should be driven by the goals that you set for yourself. Are you looking for more income-oriented goals to replace, you know, income that you were earning at your job? If that's true, then you would have a certain set of objectives around your investments. If you don't need income and you're looking to, you know, grow your assets, you would make a different set of decisions. So not skipping the goal-setting step, I think, is really important. So goals come before thesis. And thesis comes before allocation. I think that's really an important way to think about it. You need to think about your wealth as a business. And every business really needs a mission before it has a product or a service. So if you think about your wealth as a business, every business is built for something. That something in the context of a family office is to achieve your goals as a family. So understanding what those goals are first, I think is a really important first step. And so having a set of advisors that you can use if you want to, but really, you know, figuring out who is the family. Is it one person? Is it your spouse? Is it your children? Are there brothers and sisters involved? Whoever those key stakeholders are, need to come together, facilitate it if needed, and define a set of goals. And you would formalize those goals in, you know, either a family charter or an investment policy statement, some sort of legacy statement where you define what they are, you write them down, and those get reviewed every quarter, every year. I'm sure we'll talk about that, you know, as our conversation goes on. But that's the general framework.
Right, right. So now they've written that down. What's then the process of turning that into then the investment thesis?
So an investment thesis starts with a set of beliefs about where value comes from and why you're the right person to capture it, right? If you're a family that made your money in, say, manufacturing, you very likely have an edge there. You understand the industry. You understand the other players. You understand what it takes to build and grow a successful manufacturing business. You might make the decision that my thesis around deploying capital is going to revolve around manufacturing because you have a set of edge there that others might not have. So the thesis basically answers, like, what do I understand well? What gives me an edge? And what returns am I willing or looking to generate? And at what risk, right? So you define those things about, again, looking back to your goals. What are my goals? What are my risk appetite? And what do I understand and know well? And the combination of those things kind of define your thesis and where you want to be deploying capital. Your thesis directs where you're deploying capital in the short term and the long term to achieve the goals that you set for yourself at the formation of your family office, if you will.
Got it. So formation process, high level, right? There's legacy statement, family charter. Then there's the translating into the investment thesis. What are some of the things that are then documented inside of an investment thesis?
So the thesis will include things like, you know, what is our yes list? What are the things that we feel really comfortable investing in? And it doesn't need to just be asset classes like venture or real estate or public markets, but more criteria. You know, we want to deploy so much per investment, or we're looking for investments that are generating a certain yield threshold, or we're looking for investments that are more total return oriented and we want to deploy capital there. So it kind of defines what are the things that we're willing to do. And just as importantly, if not even more importantly, it considers things that you're not willing to do, things that you explicitly won't invest in. They're non-negotiables. You know, we're not investing in certain geographies, or we're not investing in certain industries, or we're not investing in types of opportunities that don't meet a certain return threshold. So you're looking for things that are just outside your bucket. And that is really helpful because it makes it easy for you to say no to things. It's easy to get overwhelmed with deal flow. People think generating deal flow is the tough part. In my opinion, that's not the hard part. The hard part is filtering the deal flow, right, to focus your time and energy and resources on the opportunities that are going to help you realize your goals. And the way that you formalize that process is by having a formal investment policy statement that dictates, these are the things we're willing to do, these are the things we're not willing to do, and you stick to that. You stick to those sort of predefined rules, if you will.
Give me an example of how, you know, in this process, you would leverage the investment, you know, thesis to be that filter. You know, maybe they say, oh, we don't do tobacco investments. And then somebody says, oh, hey, there's this great, you know, tobacco farm. It's like, that's easy. But what are maybe some examples of something that, you know, looks interesting, but then once you go a level down into the thesis, you realize like, oh, that's not a fit for what we do.
Yeah. So, I mean, at a high level, you know, most deals die in the no, right? If you have a clear no thesis, then 80% or so of opportunities that come your way should self-filter. And that makes it easy. You don't have to think about it because you've already predefined what your goals are. And if an opportunity you're looking at doesn't fit that, it's easy to say no. The best investors, in my opinion, aren't the ones that are great at saying yes. They're better at saying no very quickly and without guilt. So doesn't fit our thesis is a complete sentence that's a sufficient reason to give a sponsor or a company that's asking for making an investment. It just doesn't fit and that's it. You don't even need to give an explanation. So I think some examples are, like you said, it could be an industry-related reason. We don't make tobacco investments. It could be this investment in my underwriting, I believe, is going to be generating an X percent return for me, and my threshold is higher, so that's just a flat no. It's in a geography that I'm not interested in getting exposure to. It's a business that's based in Africa, and I don't want to be investing in Africa for whatever your reasons are. So those are some reasons that are, you know, you can easily just filter and say, not for me, not for me, and not feel guilty about it. And the reason that you don't feel guilty about it is because you predefined what your goals are, and you know exactly the kinds of opportunities that will help you achieve those goals. And so you can very easily say, no, thank you, not for me. And so I think speed is a critical skill in being able to, you know, evaluate opportunities efficiently. And saying no quick is what's more important than say yes quick.
Right, right. Well, and I mean, I think this is one of the things I think that for first generation high net worth is so important to learn. And I think it's important that people maybe even press the rewind button on this a couple times. But having clarity around the no is much more important than having a, you know, automated yes button, right? Because that's where I've seen people get in trouble too, is things they don't know or don't understand, but they get fixated on a return versus the what you're articulating is almost the reverse of that.
Yeah, and there's other examples too. You know, it's an opportunity where there's a great operator, but it's in a sector that you don't understand. It's deep tech, it's biotech, it's highly specialized insurance or financials, and you know, you made your money in the food business, and that's where you're comfortable. Well, then biotech, even though it might be a very impressive opportunity, very impressive founder, I just don't understand it. It's not for me, right? Or it has strong returns on paper, but let's say the opportunity requires your active involvement for some reason, and you're just not in a position where you can provide that active involvement. You're not structured that way. Well, that's an easy one. I'm just not able to do this. That's a no. Or another classic one is like, it's my friend's business. You know, it's a strong relationship. My friend brought me this opportunity. I trust them, but the returns aren't clear. The exit isn't so clear. And maybe from a thesis fit standpoint, it's just not a good fit, even if it's your friend's business. So there's different reasons why things might not be good, but having discipline to be able to recognize when it's not a thesis fit and be able to have the discipline around saying no to an opportunity because it's not a good thesis fit. You know, attractiveness and thesis are two separate evaluations.
Wow, that's important. That's important delineation, right? That you can have something can be attractive, but then you have to actually go off of your thesis. And I really like what you say, because operating from a thesis does give you this peace of mind. It helps you remove the emotion, whether that, as you mentioned, is you know, FOMO, regret, whatever it may be, right? It provides a ton of clarity.
Totally, 100% right.
So once the thesis is clear, how do they then start understanding how much do they want to start allocating to things like capital preservation, growth, and income?
So I think it starts with the goals that you define. The goals that you define determine what you're looking to achieve, and then different types of investments have different types of risk profiles and therefore have different types of return. And so you kind of come up with this strategy around, you know, the goals that you defined, each bucket maps to a goal. Maybe there's some portion of your goal is around preservation, right? Legacy, principal protection, non-negotiables. This bucket, I'm not willing, my risk appetite for this bucket is very low. Then there could be an income-oriented bucket, though, lifestyle, funding, operational expenses, distributions, those kinds of things have a certain risk threshold and provide a certain benefit in the form of current income. Then there's a growth bucket, right? It's long-term compounding, next generation wealth, higher return in general, but higher risk attached to it. And so the ratio between those different buckets really isn't universal. It's more a function of current income needs, what age or stage of life are you in, what kind of existing liquidity do you have, and what risk tolerance are you comfortable with. And so the combination of those things determine what amount of my investable net worth goes into each bucket. And then you blend the expected returns across all three, and you come up with a profile of what you think an allocation that looks like this will do for me, and does that achieve my goals? I think a common mistake, and I'll just mention this, is that most people tend to over-allocate to growth because it's exciting. And that's true. It can be very exciting. But if you're pulling growth from, you know, funding your lifestyle, you're eating your own compounding potentially. And so I think it's important to, again, be disciplined around your thesis and not over allocate to growth or any other bucket, for example. Be self-reflective and review your thesis every quarter or every year against where your capital actually is to make sure that, you know, my portfolio is actually meeting my thesis and therefore achieving the goals that I've set for myself.
And so when you're going through this build process, it sounds like then you've transitioned from almost the goal setting to then setting the principles to now this is going to involve some type of modeling, like you're actually creating some level of financial models with output to get everything aligned. Is that sort of how it works?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. You know, I think that you'll basically get to a position, a place where you're looking at, you know, position sizing, concentration limits, what does my liquidity profile look like? So from a position sizing standpoint, you know, how much do we want to put in any single investment? You know, most family offices have hard caps, you know, maybe it's 10 to 15% of your portfolio won't be in any single position. And that's the maximum. You know, maybe some families are more comfortable with five, some may be a little bit higher. So for example, if you're a family that maybe you made your wealth in the food space, you know it super well, you know what their risks are, you know that you have an edge and that you can really help create value, maybe your risk appetite is a little bit higher, so you're willing to put more of your portfolio in that space because you really feel comfortable there. And other families who are more generalist in approach, and so they're putting maybe 5% in any one bucket to kind of really make sure the diversification benefits are there. And then, you know, concentration limits, they exist really to prevent thesis drift, right? You love a sector, for example, and slowly over-allocate to it. Well, if you're always checking back against your thesis and then, you know, doing quarterly reviews against your portfolio, you'll understand and be able to see when that's happening and be able to adjust before you're over-allocated to a particular, you know, asset class or industry, for example.
And it sounds like when you're operating at that level, there is a, you know, a larger allocation to private markets. I mean, you're talking about, you know, owning private businesses, owning different pieces of real estate. Do you find that, you know, from your exposure, there tends to be a greater allocation to private markets than public markets in the family office?
Again, I think it's hard to generalize that because families have different goals and different risk tolerances and whatnot. In my opinion, private markets really do belong in a well-designed portfolio as a source of return premium and diversification from public market volatility. But the amount in which each family is comfortable allocating to private markets differs. You know, there's liquidity considerations between public markets and private markets and other things. So it kind of depends on what your goals are. So where do private markets fit? I mean, obviously they fit in the growth bucket. They can also fit in the income bucket. You know, you and I are invested in a couple of deals together where it's a private market deal, but it's a highly current income oriented private market deal. So there's growth oriented private markets opportunities as well as income oriented ones. But it's important to understand things like the hold period and what the exit mechanics are in a private markets opportunity because the liquidity is generally less. And so before you make a commitment, you kind of want to understand, what does this mean for me over the next 3, 5, 7 years, both from the mechanics of the particular deal itself, but also from my own personal situation around my liquidity needs and other things that you would want to think about before allocating something where there is, you know, potential for there to be lack of liquidity for years, not weeks or months, let's say, versus a public market opportunity.
when you start looking at private market investments, like what is your high level due diligence approach?
Certainly who you're investing with is important. If it's a fund oriented opportunity, you want to understand what the track record of the sponsor is. What are the risks of this investment? So I'm generally looking for reasons to say no first, right? I want to look at an investment. You know, humans are wired for optimism bias. You know, you evaluate upside naturally, and I think it's the downside that really requires deliberate effort from the part of the human. So thinking first about what could go wrong here, why am I getting access to this opportunity? Let's say an investment bank sends me an opportunity to take a look at. Some of my first thoughts are, why are they sending this to me? How many people passed on this before it landed on my desk? You know, like, do I have a special relationship with this person for me to kind of be thinking about this as like a proprietary opportunity, or am I number, you know, investor number 100 that's taking a look at this? You know, so like, I want to understand why should I say no to this opportunity? What could go wrong? You know, it really forces you to stress test kind of the thesis before you fall in love with it. You know, by thinking about what could go wrong, it reveals things like execution risk. Is there market risk? What about operator risk, illiquidity risk? Is there legal or structural considerations I should be thinking through? I think, you know, a practical approach is, you know, write down the three most likely ways that you think something goes wrong before you do anything else. And if you can get past those things and you still think it's interesting, okay, well, now maybe there's something there. And then you can start thinking about what could go right here. What does my upside look like? You know, what do I need to believe for this opportunity to have a positive outcome? And so for me, I think it's starting with, why should I not do this? And if you can't come up with a reason not to do it, then it's like, okay, now let me think about why I should do this. But I think it's also important to think about the fact that, you know, no one bats 1,000. Right. You will make investments that don't perform. And so for me, the key is not wasting the learning opportunity that comes from being wrong. If you're following your thesis and you're managing the risk appropriately, being wrong some of the time won't kill you, but not taking the chance to learn from a mistake, I think might in the long run. And so for those that are new, if you're able to use your current knowledge, your understanding, make investments against your thesis, understand that not everyone is going to go right, but have the discipline to review, do a postmortem, and really understand, what was I thinking when I made this investment? What actually ended up happening? And where was I wrong in my assessment? So that the next time you can be a little bit smarter than the time before. And over months, years of doing this, you start to build a knowledge base that will minimize or limit the amount of times that you're wrong. And that's how you get better over time.
Well, that's how you ultimately build a slight edge, right? That is that, you know, half of a percentage point better, 1% better, percent better every time. That's what then gives that opportunity. And I can imagine that then in a family office, if they're actually storing that knowledge and then passing that on, like, that creates, you know, incredible advantage in addition to ongoing relationships. It's real. That's incredibly powerful. I think I just want people to drink that in, because, you know, as you're starting this journey, these are some of the fundamentals that you can see build skills that compound over your lifetime and then especially over generations. I want to now switch back, go back up as we're thinking through, we're architecting, we've, you know, created the legacy statement, the investment thesis, we're starting to deploy capital. Let's talk about governance for a moment. So in a large family office, I want to understand, what's the construct around who makes investment decisions, or does the policy really dictate that? And then that can be delegated to different advisors. And then what is the mechanism that decides, like, what can, you know, be a decision that moves quickly versus something that needs more time?
I think, you know, most family offices use some combination of a tiered or split authority model. On one hand, you have a CIO or investment committee, whether it's, you know, an investment committee that's made up of family members plus some internal resources like a CIO, or it's a it's an investment committee that's made up of a completely external advisors, you know, some version of that. They'll make decisions when it's an investment that's like above a certain dollar threshold. But on the other hand, if it's an investment that, you know, it's a recurring investment, it's a follow-on investment for one that we already have exposure to, maybe it's a rebalancing decision or some sort of cash management, those things you can probably do without a committee. And the internal team has the freedom to make some of those decisions kind of on their own for speed and efficiency purposes. There's fast track criteria that will fit a thesis pretty closely within an existing relationship, maybe, or it's a known structure, or it's within predefined concentration limits, then we can move fast. But if it's a more deep review criteria, it's a new asset class, it's a new relationship, it's a large commitment, maybe it's a really complex structure, you know, it's illiquid for, you know, some long period of time, that's more of a full committee approach. And so the opportunity kind of dictates which of those two it goes down. But, you know, high level buckets are full review or delegated authority. And depending on kind of what the opportunity is, it goes into one of those buckets.
And that I know is dictated then in the investment policy. So the policy will go through and say, oh, follow on, boom, here's what we do. Oh, if it's over our traditional size, that's going to require a full committee. So it's truly like a business where you have standard operating procedures and you can go to the checklist and say, okay, here's what it's going to require if we want to get this through.
That's exactly right. And, you know, certain governance frameworks that family offices have to a certain extent dictate what kinds of opportunities they can ultimately participate in. So a very large multi-billion dollar family office might have a 8-person investment committee that's made up of all external resources. And that committee meets once a quarter, let's say. They're maybe not able to participate in certain opportunities that require a fast decision cadence, because they're just not structured to be able to meet more frequently than once per quarter. Other family offices might be more flexible and more nimble, where they, you know, or have their investment committees made up of family members that are involved in the family office and internal resources. So they can meet on a moment's notice if they need to. So they're able to kind of participate in opportunities that other family offices just aren't structured for. But the point is that that's an intentional decision made by the family around how we want to operate. And that, as you noted, is defined in the investment policy statement, the family charter, and the governance documents, so that if it's, hey, you know, we have this opportunity, but we need to make a decision next week, if you're structured to meet once a quarter, then it's just not for us. It's an easy no. It can be as attractive as any other opportunity, but we're just not structured to fix something like that. It's just not for us. And you pass and you move on. So that's what where the governance kind of comes in, to help dictate how you operate.
Let's talk a little bit about the families. Like, you know, I think for many of us, you know, growing up middle class, I know myself, right? I talk about this, that, you know, I was taught that you don't talk about money. You know, you don't talk about it. The dinner table is very impolite. Now there's these families where, you know, they're having kids involved. It's almost this family business. What have you seen and observed in some of these different families that works really well with families involved in the business versus, you know, others that aren't? I'm sure that your perspective and your observation, like, you've seen a lot of different flavors. What does a successful one look like?
Again, if you've seen one family office, you've seen one, right? There's no silver bullet, you know, that works for everybody. So in my experience, there are family offices where there's one individual is the person who's kind of the authority figure and making the decisions. And any sort of children or spouses or extended family, they're just not involved. It's one person's decision to make, and that's the way that they're comfortable operating. Other people have multiple generations involved. So you have like a husband and wife, they have adult children. And so all three or four or five of them, however many there are involved in decision-making. And maybe it's some combination, like we said before, where if it's a big decision above a certain threshold, we all get involved. If it's a smaller decision or a smaller, you know, less importance, one person can make a decision on behalf of the family. It's important to think about in the goal-setting phase, who do we want to be involved here? And it's not only family members, but it extends to advisors and CPAs and attorneys. Now, what role do all of those people play as well, right? Different people have different roles. And I think ultimately that needs to be explicit. So for like spouses and family, immediate family members, it's goal level decisions, right? Major allocation shift, values-based constraints, but not day-to-day execution necessarily. A CPA, for example, you know, they get involved when there's tax considerations or investment structures that require different tax, you know, complications or things to think about, entity selection, but not investment selection. An attorney is more like a legal structure, right? They get involved in the documentation. They get involved in estate planning implications, but they're not involved in investment selection either. And then advisors can inform and be, you know, exactly that, advisors, but ultimately they shouldn't control, you know, what investments are getting made or not. And it's important to be careful about conflicts of interest. Well, the governance failure is when everyone has an opinion on what's going on and then no one is accountable for anything, right? So you kind of need to have a clear delineation of roles, understand who's responsible for what, who's accountable for what, and then everyone stays in their own lane.
Are there usually those types of governance frameworks? Have you seen those written down before? So it's this very clear, like, here's how we're making decisions. We've agreed on it. We've signed off on it, like you would have in a business.
Yeah, I think so. Because again, you don't want to be dealing with that when it's time to be making decisions, right? You want to have that kind of thing defined first, whether it's in your charter or your investment policy or some other governing or operating documentation. You want to understand, how are we making decisions? Who's involved? Whose sign off do we need? So that when a decision needs to be made, it's known how we go about making it, not scrambling at the last minute to figure out, okay, now who do we need to get involved here? You know, you should have all that defined ahead of time.
Defined up front. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, legacy statement, we have investment thesis, investment policy, things are being invested. Let's talk about, what's the cadence that keeps this all alive? And I know that this was something we talked about in our second interview, is investment thesis, legacy statement, all of these architecture documents are, they're strategic business plans. They're living, breathing documents. What is the cadence that you've seen, you know, they're updated and then they're operated to and reflected on?
Yeah. So here would be my recommendation as far as that goes. On a quarterly basis, you do an operational review. Is the portfolio performing within expected ranges? Are there capital calls that are coming? Any distributions we need to be aware of, or other types of events on our calendar related to our investments? You kind of review the portfolio and its performance on a quarterly basis, let's say. On an annual basis, you keep that to things that are more around thesis and policy. Have our goals changed? Mm. Has the market changed in a way that requires readjusting the allocation? Has there been an event-triggered reason for us to review this, which would, I think, would fall outside of a quarterly or annual review? So say there's a major life event, someone passes away, someone gets divorced, someone gets married. You know, those things I think might require kind of a off-schedule review, if you will, but are reasons to still review kind of where you are. So I think a quarterly cadence around portfolio performance and portfolio review makes sense. An annual cadence around thesis and policy, with flexibility to be able to have a review outside of those windows if there's an event that requires it. So I think, you know, a good quarterly review, what does that look like? You know, you're looking at things like performance versus your benchmark, but more importantly, performance versus my goals. I am looking to generate a 10% annualized return on my portfolio. Am I hitting that goal or am I not? I'm looking to benchmark my return versus the S&P 500. Am I hitting that benchmark or am I not? I think those are two distinct questions. And I would put more importance around, am I hitting my goals or am I not? In addition to, you know, performance versus a benchmark or something, like, what is my liquidity? What's coming in, what's going out, and what's locked up? You would certainly want to review that on a quarterly basis as well.
Right.
Are there any investments that are drifting from our thesis? What reason is it that they're drifting, and is there anything we can do about it? And any decisions that we made last quarter, let's review those as well and see if we're following our own rules. So those are some things that you would be looking at on kind of a quarterly basis with either yourself, if you're running your own family office, or with your, you know, your internal set of advisors or family members if you're structured that way.
In thinking for a moment of you know, like some tax structured alpha, is there also then a complement, right? You're looking at your revenue, but then you also start looking at what are some of your expenses and taxes. Is that also folded into that quarterly business review?
Totally. So I guess I would focus my comments on from a portfolio standpoint. As a family office, you have a P&L, right? If you're a formal institutional family office, what is your P&L? It's, you know, the cost of people, my cost to operate. Do I have, you know, a lease I'm dealing with? What kind of technology do I have? You know, you have a P&L like you would any other business. And so for that, I think even a monthly cadence, understanding your kind of P&L from a, you know, operating perspective at the family office is important, right? Because if you're expecting, in the same way that you would in any other business, you should have a budget for running your family office. And yes, you want to understand, are you meeting that budget or are you not? Where do I need to adjust? And I think even a monthly review of those numbers is important. Now, the family themselves may not get involved in that. That may be a CEO or some other executive at the family office that's dealing with right. That part of it. The family may be more, you know, just on the portfolio side of things, but certainly a review of, you know, your operating budget at a family office makes sense. And the same is true, by the way, whether you're running your own microfamily office. You know, you want to understand, where am I spending money? Am I spending a ton of money on attorneys reviewing deals that aren't closing? You know, you probably want to make an adjustment if that's the case. Or am I spending a bunch of money on technology that I'm not using for some reason? Like, right. do I have a subscription to Adapar for $50,000 a month? And I'm a one-person show. You know, I might not need that. Right. So consistently being able to self-evaluate, you know, where am I in my spend, I think is important. And you do that whether you're an institutional quality family office or you're running your own family office as well.
Now, for you and on the chief investment officer side, do you have these postmortems that you were talking about earlier? Is that something that you do on a quarterly basis or do you do that on a different cadence?
So I do that more on my own. You know, it's my responsibility to kind of understand our portfolio, make recommendations around, you know, decisions for new investments, review our existing investments when they're going well or when they're not. And so for me, in my role as CIO, I like to understand why something didn't go well, you know, if that happens, and it does. But I don't wait to do that analysis every quarter. You know, I like to do that right away, right? I want to understand, like, okay, let me go back to my notes, to my investment memo. What was I thinking when we made this decision? And now while it's fresh, let me understand why it didn't work and then match those two things together so I can understand what the lesson is. And to me, the best time to do that is when it's fresh, not once a quarter or once a year, because you forget at that point. So I tend to do that kind of postmortem on an as-needed basis.
Well, I think we've definitely covered full circle for what we wanted to do for this topic. The one question I would ask you as we're wrapping up is, if you could give one piece of advice to somebody who's beginning this journey of creating their own microfamily office, what would it be?
Most people at this wealth level built something exceptional. Then, you know, they consider hiring an advisor to manage their wealth, effectively handing the keys to someone else and hoping for the best. They feel like they're not supposed to actively manage their wealth. That's what professionals are for, right? My advice would be, stop being a passenger in your own financial life. You have permission to understand this. It's not complex. It's just not been taught. And the moment that you stop outsourcing your curiosity, everything changes, right? Treat your wealth and your microfamily office as a business. The CEO seat is empty, right? Sit in it.
Wow. Well, thank you so much. Always appreciate the time, Marco. And I know you probably have like an investment review, quarterly business review or something to get to, but always appreciate your time. Thank you.
Of course. Thanks for having me. Great to be here.